And I want to give you a little information about the speaker. I am honored that I got to really pick the speaker this year. It's somebody I've been knowing, and I didn't realize it had been so long until we were at dinner, her and I. And we actually spoke together at a convention, a women's convention. I go to a lot of women's conferences. And I happened to have been the Friday night speaker, and she was the Saturday night speaker. And I just realized it's been over 15 years ago. And it was so interesting because within that 15 years, we have been running in the same circles. And we were talking about holding up that light. And one of the most challenging things for me as an old timer is finding a woman, because I've got 33 years, with more experience than myself, that's still making AA meetings, that still have to work the steps, that still is into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can pick up the phone and I can call somebody, because I still need to pick up the phone and call somebody. And Evelyn has been one of those people that I have picked up the phone and called. And she was able to help me with resentments and things that I thought I had gotten rid of a long time ago. But I found that they do return. But it's how you recognize them and handle them that show the extent of your progress here. And so it's so good for me to have somebody I can call, because sometimes we don't. They had an article in the Grapevine that say, whatever happened to the old timers? Because not all of them drink, but some of them just stopped making AA meetings. And so I'm just really grateful. We were always running in the same circles, and it's just like I tell my sponsees, don't do what I say, do what I do. And I looked up and I started seeing Evelyn in the same circles I was running. And one time, a couple of times, I even seen her at our state assembly. And I thought, why is she at our state assembly? She lives in New York. And I didn't realize she had moved to Savannah. And so there she was in service just like I was. And this is the type of woman that I am just so grateful to have in my life, still working the program. And I'd like to introduce Evelyn Wilson.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Evelyn, and I am an alcoholic. And may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in God's sight. Here I am, your humble servant, Evelyn, to help somebody this day. And I'm always reminded to say that upon wakening in the morning, because there were many, many mornings prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous in which I awoken and wish I had not. I can remember, well, let me just, they say, begin at the beginning, how it was and how it is now. I was born and bred in Harlem, New York. Now, there are some that would say that alone is enough to make anyone stand before you and tell a story like mine. I was born April 30th, 1941. I am 74 years young. And I'm an only child. I have never witnessed any drinking, any drug use, any cursing, any type of carryings on in my home. I was an only child that was not only felt loved. I was told I was loved. I was kissed. I was hugged every day. And I was sharing with someone last night that I think there were two or three stillborn children that my parents had. My parents are from Georgetown, South Carolina. Both of them were born and bred in Georgetown, South Carolina. And they must have migrated in the 30s, as a lot of African-American families do. They migrate north for a better quality of life. And so I'm one of the first generations to have been born in New York City. And my mother and father brought all the old Southern school values and qualities with them. They were good people. They went to church every Sunday. I went to Sunday school every Sunday. Sunday school, and then stayed for church services. And I never saw any of the stuff that I got into in my mother and father's home. Now, my father died. He had stomach cancer when I was 11 years old. I didn't know what stomach cancer was. I just knew that Daddy used to be sick all the time. I never saw him smoke a cigarette. I never saw him take a drink. Never in my life. Nobody in my family ever knew my father to drink or smoke. He just didn't. It wasn't that he was in AA or overtly religious. He just never drank and smoked. My mother might have drank maybe Christmas or New Year's or a little social drinking, but I didn't see that in my home. My father died, like I said, when I was 11. My mother died when I was, they died 6 months apart, I'll put it that way. And here I was with no sisters and brothers. And I guess I was confused, bewildered. First of all, I didn't know any families on my block, any other children that didn't have brothers or sisters. All of my friends had at least 5 to 8 brothers and sisters. They had big families. My girlfriend, there was 15 in their family. The boys lived in apartment 8, and the girls lived in apartment B. And they were a big family, and it was like going to the circus when you went to their house, you know? You could jump on the bed, and you could do all that with your shoes on. You couldn't do none of that in my mother's home. You couldn't walk near my mother's bed, let alone jump on my mother's bed with your shoes on. But anyway, and I didn't know anybody that didn't have a mother and father. There was nobody in my neighborhood that didn't have a mother and father. And when I say nobody had a mother and father, there were no single families in my neighborhood. As poor as we were, every child that I knew had a mother and father. Now, Mr. Jones might have got drunk on Saturday night and fought Mrs. Jones. And the police had to come and put Mr. Jones out. But Monday morning, Mr. Jones was back in that house. Okay? And that's the way it was. So when my parents died, I think I was kind of confused and bewildered. But I still cannot say that is what caused me to become an alcoholic. I went simply across the street. My mother's sister's daughter lived across the street from us. And in those days, there were no child welfare. If there were, my family didn't know anything about foster care or child welfare agency or DFACS or any of that. If somebody in the family died and there was a bed in somebody's house, you just went over there and you lived. So I never changed schools. I went right across the street. I lived in number 108, and my cousin Lorme lived in 105, and I went across the street and I lived over there. And I went to the same school. I was in the 8th grade when all this happened. And Lorme, on the other hand, drank, though. Now, Lorme is what we would call in AA a weekend warrior. Lorme used to drink on the weekends only. I've never known how she did. They would start, her and her girlfriend Maddie, and all the other women that she used to be, about 5 of them. They would get around the kitchen table, and they would call the runner. In front of the liquor stores, it was always a runner, a wino, who, if you gave him a quarter, he would bring a pint of liquor up to the house, a quarter or 50 cents, and they would all chip in a dollar or so, and they would get a pint of J.W. Dan. I'll never forget it. And they would drink that pint, and when that pint was gone, they would get on the phone, call the liquor store. Here come the same runner again, bringing another pint. And this went on all night Friday, all day Saturday. Come Sunday, Lord, not a drink. Dr. Jive and WWRL, the R&B radio went off. Gospels, you could hear it all through the house. Gospel music running, all the Dixie hummingbirds and everybody singing, and no drinking, and everybody in that house except Lorme got up and went to Sunday school and went to church. Lorme didn't, but we all did. She had three children. And this went on for years. And we used to say, I wonder how long, I still didn't know. She died a few years back at the age of 86. I never knew how Lorme could stop drinking like that. Get up and cook bacon and egg. The smell of those bacon and eggs used to make me nauseous. Get up, eat, no drinking. The following Friday, her, Maddie, and all of them get around the table. They start drinking again, and this went on until Sunday. Until I moved out, until I was a grown person and moved out. Now, what happened in the interim, me and my girlfriend Laverne, we decided, because Lorme would change up on Fridays. I had to be upstairs at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, come hell or high water, during the weekdays. I had chores to do, and I better do them. I wasn't treated any different than her three children. Come Friday, if I want to stay downstairs till 10:30, Lorme starts smiling inappropriately. She never smiled. You know, if I didn't wash the dishes right or didn't make the bed, she'd smile. And if I asked her to give me another quarter, she'd give me 50 cents. Me and Laverne used to say, damn, I wonder what's in that stuff Lorme is drinking that make her nice like that. And I used to say, I don't know what the hell it is, but I wish she drank it all week long. Because she was the nicest person when she drank, and when she wasn't drinking, it wasn't that she was mean, it's just that she went back to her stern, strict ways. And she was so loose when she wasn't drinking, right? So me and Laverne decided, one Friday night, we was going to steal some of this stuff. Me and Laverne stole a glass. Laverne had a water glass. I had a water glass. We put a half a glass of the J.W. Dan, went in the bathroom. I lived in a railroad apartment. Those of you who don't know what a railroad apartment is, railroad apartments in New York at that time was, here's the kitchen, the bathroom, the bedroom, a bedroom, another living room, and then you just railroad right on out until you came on out, and then you start up again, you know. And me and Laverne drank this liquor, and we didn't have to go past them, so we just railroaded on out to the back door. So me and Laverne, I'm holding on to the sink. I said, I don't know whether my head's going to blow up. I don't know what's going to happen. And me and Laverne drank it down, and we held on and quenched it. And it burned going down, and I looked at Laverne, and I said, shit, burn going down. I said, I don't feel nothing. I said, Laverne, you feel burn? I said, I don't feel nothing. So we railroaded out the apartment going downstairs. Well, at the corner block, there was a little jukebox joint. And in those days, you put a quarter in the jukebox, and that 78 record spin up in the air. You put a quarter in and spin up in the air, and it came down, and then that needle came on it, and the Drifters were singing Up on the Roof. Now, I had heard Up on the Roof I don't know how many times, but by the time I got downstairs to that fourth, we lived in a fourth floor tenement. We had to walk up fourth floor. It was like he was singing that. I had never heard that record like that in my life. I mean, I was swooning, and you would have thought I lived on 68th Street and Park Avenue instead of 119 in Harlem and Park Avenue. And me and Laverne, I said, Laverne, I see two of you. Laverne said, I see two of you, too. And I mean, we was just, and I didn't know a human being could feel that good. And ladies and gentlemen, in that instant, I became an alcoholic. And I'll tell you why I became an alcoholic. It is not so much that it felt so good, because God knows that felt good. But I decided next weekend I wasn't going to tell Laverne shit. I was going up there by myself, and all that liquor, I was not only going to drink my glass, I was going to drink hers. Now, I'm 12 years old, right? And I made it up in my mind that I said, I ain't telling Laverne nothing next weekend. So now next weekend, I'm Laverne, she's a bigger alcoholic as I am still to this day, right? But she ain't in AA. She come up, you going upstairs? I said, I can't open my mouth. I've been up there 2-3 times by now. I can't open my mouth. I'm drunk. She said, I said, Laverne, they ain't up there. I ain't heard nothing for an ounce. I said, they ain't up there. They ain't up there. Laverne said, what you mean? Lorme never went nowhere on the weekends. Every weekend by clockwork, Lorme was up in that house and they was ordering that liquor every single weekend for at least 10 years. Laverne said, what you mean they ain't up there? I said, I've been up there, Laverne. Ain't nobody in the house. Ain't nobody. I'm lying. I'm 12. Right? And from then on in, I stole that liquor and drank it by myself. And ladies and gentlemen, that's the way I drank until I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you might have been my friend. You might have been my cut buddy. We might go through thick and thin. But when it came to that booze, you wasn't getting none. You wasn't getting none of my... I always, always carried a big bag. And I always had me a big bottle in it just in case wherever I went, whoever I was with. If they didn't have it, they ain't going to get much slack out of me. I might act like I'm a little T.O. because they ain't have it. But I had my stuff always. Always had it. And that's the way I drank. When I was old enough to go into the 3-for-1 bars, and there used to be a 3-for-1 bar on 122nd Street and Park Avenue. Those of you who don't know what a 3-for-1 is, 3-for-1 is you can get 3 shorties for $1. You can get 3 drinks for $1. And we used to run in and out of there. I think I was like 17, 18. I'm pretty much the same height I am now that I was when I was 13. So I was kind of like taller than everybody else. But everybody else grew up, and I never grew no more. So I was able to go in the bars, and we were always making up and putting on, wait till we come outside, and then we put on all this makeup and act like we were so old and go in these bars and drink. That 3-for-1, I loved it. I found a 4-for-1, a Spanish bar down on 125th Street, Lexington Avenue, in a Puerto Rican neighborhood. I was the only person in that bar that wasn't Puerto Rican. Them people speaking Spanish all around me. All the barmaid, the bartender was Spanish. Everybody. I didn't give a damn. 4-for-1, I took the bus. I used to go down there and I would sit in that bar from the time they opened it until the time they closed it. Loved it. When I was old enough to go in the bars legally, I loved the bar life. Always loved. And in those days, Billie Holiday and Diana Washington, they used to come up from playing jazz downtown in the Blue Note and the come up to the Red Rooster, and they would come up and they would be drinking and smoking weed, and we could slip into the back and listen to Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane and all those jazz musicians that used to come. And you couldn't tell us we weren't in the life. And this was before heroin came into Harlem. See, when heroin came into Harlem, it kind of just ruined the neighborhood. But we used to... we used to... We never locked our door as a kid. When it was time to paint, you know, like every 2 years in them tenement houses, you get the landlord buy you paint, but you paint. Mama, I ain't painting. We move. You know, if it's time to paint, we move to a freshly painted apartment. That's the way we used to live. I hardly ever had to go to the movies. On Friday night, I put a pillow in our window and just get in that window and watch
the cuttings and the shootings and the whatever else was going on. And that was the movies, you know. I never went to the movies. I didn't have to go to see no Westerns and whatnot. I could just watch people coming out the bar, shooting one another and cutting up one another and whatnot. It was a way of life. It was a way of life. And it became a way of life that I lived for many, many years. See, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1968, I think I was like 20, I might have been 25, 24, something like that. And I looked around. Everybody in AA was as old as I am now, right? And I'm looking around. I said, I'm going to be the only one on 7th Avenue and Lenox Avenue in Harlem that ain't drinking. I ain't going into no AA. I needed Alcoholics Anonymous then. But I thought I was too young. I thought I was too slick. And I thought I knew too much. So I wasn't even thinking about AA. I came in at the suggestion of, if I'd be here all night to tell you my story, my husband, who thought he was Mr. Nicky Barnes, and I thought I was Miss Nicky Barnes, and we doing more of the product than we selling. He's staying in and out of jail. I was married for 19 years. I spent 17 years over Rikers Island talking through that thick window that you talk through on the telephone when you go to see somebody locked up. You know, it was just, it was a crazy, horrendous life. And I always say, AA afforded me the opportunity to live two lives. Sometimes I look back, I'm 43 years sober now, and I look back on the way I lived back then, and that was as normal as this life is. This life today is normal to me, but that life was just as normal. And when I came into AA and they were talking about not living that kind of, I said, what you expect me to do? I'm going to be the only one ain't drinking, the only one ain't drugging, the only one ain't doing, committing crimes and all of that. I said, I wasn't having it. So I went back out. And I didn't even call it going back out because I ain't never told nobody I was in the first place. Okay? I can remember the first meeting I went to, and this man named Walter came running over to me. And in them days, if 10 people was in the Riverton group, that's my home group in Harlem, there was a lot of people. You never had this many people in an AA meeting, no meeting in Harlem. It was no more than 10 or 15 people. So they come running over to me. A woman named Rita brought me in, and Walter come running over to me. When did you have your last drink? I looked at him. I said, my last drink? I had my last drink. I don't know what he was talking about when I had my last drink. Like I had my last drink. I went home and told my husband. You know, I said, this man come running over to me and said to me, when did you have your last drink? And I said, I hadn't had my last drink. So I went for a while, because if I wasn't going, I was getting the, see, I was either in the hospital for drinking, for withdrawals, because I was like 88 pounds soaking wet in them days. And if I got a hunger pain and I was drinking, I wouldn't eat nothing. Because I knew that once you eat something, you lost your high. So I could get all the hunger pains I want. I wasn't losing my high by eating nothing, and I didn't eat. So I would go weeks without eating anything. And at the end of that, I was crawling around. I had alcoholic myopathy. I couldn't hardly walk. And I was like in my early 20s. I looked like I looked today when I was 19. I was looking back. I mean, I was looking bad when I was 18, 19 years old. And I go into AA and I'm listening now, because my sister-in-law, who I hated with a passion, who I thought she used to work for Percy Sutton and David Dinkins, who was the mayor of New York around that time, and she told me, she said, well, why don't you just go in for a while? Because they knew if they said anything to me about not drinking, it wasn't going to happen. So she said, go in for a while. Now, I heard for a while. So I goes to meeting. Now, I'm under the impression everybody there, ain't but 10, 15 people, everybody is there to kind of learn how to drink. You know, that's what I'm thinking people are there for. I didn't know nobody. I swear to God, I knew nobody that didn't drink, do drugs, and commit crime. If they did, I didn't know them.
I didn't know nobody. Everybody I knew was doing something. So I'm going to meetings, and I say, well, at some point, Whip say, my husband, Whip say, well, what they say? I say, Whip, I don't know. I say, ain't nobody, you know, they got something on the wall there they call steps, and you supposed to read them steps and stuff like that. So I'm going and stuff. I'm thinking at some point somebody going to pull out a bottle and give you a little bit to drink and see how you do, you know. And when you come back, if you do okay, then you get a little more until you get to know what to do. That's what I'm thinking going to happen. I ain't never thought that nobody in AA, because I certainly didn't think I wasn't going to drink no more. So I go home one night. I'm coming from Mid-Harlem. I got home that night, and I remember at the Apollo, there was this movie, Badass, was playing. And I come home, and I said, you know, Rip, I think them people don't drink. Because I ran up to this woman named Bessie. And I eased up against Bessie, and Bessie was one of them AA big book thumpers. I said, well, miss, because she was older than me, you know. So when I'm trying to get something out, I'm going to act polite. Miss, when do you think we're going to get something to drink, you know, and they're going to eat? Lord, I tell you, she ripped me a new one. Bessie starts screaming on 124th Street. We don't do no drinking in here. It's a day at a time. Blah, 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 blah. So I go home. I said, Whip, I don't think them people ever drink. I don't think they ever going to drink. So Whip say, never? I said, I don't think they ever. Whip say, ain't no point in you going back. He said, ain't no point in you going back. And I didn't. And I didn't go back. I said, ain't no point in me going back. But what happened, ladies and gentlemen, is alcohol, whether you think you're an alcoholic or not, whether I think I'm an alcoholic or not, if you continue to drink alcohol, you will be shown that you are an alcoholic. And I was shown that I was an alcoholic. So a couple of years later, now I'm in the hospital for the 8th time having my stomach pumped out. Because you know those Deer Park bottles that the water comes in? When I would wake up, they would have one of those bottles near me on my bed, and they would have a tube running down my throat where they would be pumping up the bile, and those bottles would be a quarter, if not halfway filled with bile. Where when I say I don't eat for a week or two, I'm not talking about a cup of soup. I may start out. Before I drink, I say, well, let me get some Campbell's noodle soup. See, it got to the point where you make allowances to be sick. I used to make allowances for my drunks. I'd go to AMP, I'd buy 15 cans of chicken noodle soup because I knew, and with this, I said, what are you buying all this damn soup for? I knew I wasn't going to be able to eat nothing for 2-3 days. If I stopped drinking, if I didn't stop drinking, I wasn't going to eat at all. And so at the end of the second or third week, you had to call the ambulance. Every time I went into detox, the ambulance was called. I couldn't walk. I was shaking. I'm knitting without needles. I'm going through, you know, I'm like this. When I first came into AA, when I came down the aisle with a cup of coffee, everybody moved out the way. Everybody moved, because I'm like this. I'm shaking. I used to be so sick. But I thought, ladies and gentlemen, that I could not live on this universe. I thought that I could not live on this universe without a drink or a drug. I didn't have a bad life. See, alcoholism is a disease. And you don't want to buy in, and I bought in at first and had I didn't buy in, but people who, when I'd go in the hospital, the doctors would look at me. In those days, in the 60s and 70s, the doctors were ashamed to talk to me as a woman being an alcoholic. No doctor ever came. Today, I've been working in the field of alcoholism now for almost 40 years. But when I used to go in and out of the hospital, no doctor ever called me an alcoholic. No nurse ever called me an alcoholic. They were ashamed. They didn't even know how to approach me. I had a well-meaning doctors say to me, "Oh, well, Miss Wilson, you got a hard life. Huh? You got, I'm black, I'm poor, and believe me not, I'm playing on this now. You know, I'm playing this. I ain't got no money. I come from a lower socioeconomic. I mean, I could play this out. Okay? If I could get you in the corner for 5 minutes, I had you buying me drinks all night telling you how bad my life is." But my life was not bad. It didn't start out bad. It got bad because I drank and drugged. That's how it got bad. And so the doctors never said anything to me. Nobody ever came to me and said, "Miss Wilson, you're an alcoholic." Nobody but you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I walked in AA, of course you're going to ask me, "When did I have my last drink?" You could look at me and tell I was an alcoholic. I think the doctors could look at me and tell I was an alcoholic, but in those days they were too embarrassed to say it. You see, so nobody told me I was an alcoholic. And so I'd leave the hospital, go right back home. First thing I do, stop at the corner Spanish grocery store and buy two cans of Coke 45. When I came into AA, I didn't know beer was alcohol. When I heard Mary R., I heard this woman talk about being in AA and the only damn thing she drank was beer. I said, "Well, who needs AA for beer? I used to drink beer to cool my hot box down. I get up in the morning, I drink four cans of beer. That's just to cool my hot box down so I can get out and drink. I never knew that you would need AA for beer." You know? How many times I'd literally leave 168th Street and Broadway, get off the bus at 148th Street and Broadway, go in the Spanish liquor store, grocery store, and buy two tall cans of Coke 45. Drink one can before I even got upstairs. And thought it was all right. My husband thought it was all right. Everybody who knew, we all drank. In them days, ain't nobody, I didn't know no, only people I knew who didn't drink was them real religious people that used to walk around with no shoes on and these long clothings and, you know, but I didn't know nobody who did, no sane person that didn't drink. I didn't know no real people that didn't drink. So I was fooled for many, many, many years. I stayed out there and I could have died. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and you knew what to tell me, this is why I tell people today. I learned from somebody 2 days sober. I learned from somebody 100 years sober. I don't care how long you're sober. You can teach me and help me to get to bed tonight without picking up a drink. And my sole purpose in life today is to get to bed tonight without picking up a drink and drug and to be able to help another suffering alcoholic. Those are the two things that helped me to stay sober. And how I follow that, I follow the steps, I follow the big book, I follow the slogans. I do what I need to do, no matter how difficult it is, to stay away from the first drink. And this is what you taught me to do. My sponsor in New York, men sponsor women, women sponsor men, we all in it together. You know, when I first started coming to meeting, it used to be nothing but Bowery men type. Men that every eight hours, if their bodies didn't have a drink, they would seize. And I was getting to that point. If I didn't have some kind of drink in me every 6 to 8 hours, I would go into a seizure. And they used to keep liquor in the back room. They used to keep a pint in the back because them guys used to fall out. And to tell you how sick I was, I went to a meeting, and I saw this guy fall out and start having a seizure, and the chairperson ran in the back and got a pint of liquor and brought it out, and they put a spoon in his mouth. They don't put a spoon in people's mouths no more, but they put a spoon in his mouth until the police and the ambulance, and then they poured it down, gave him something to drink. I said, "Shit, when I come back here tomorrow, I'm falling out, so I could get me something to drink." I ain't never had no money. Never had no money. And the hardest thing in the world is try to stay high and stay drunk, and you ain't got no money. Forget about you ain't got nothing to drink. You ain't got no money to buy nothing to drink with. And in them days, you had to look like something if you wanted somebody to buy you a drink. And I couldn't stay sober long enough to look like nobody. So when I saw them with that liquor, I never shared nothing with nobody because I was always conniving and scheming. As soon as I come back next day, doing the secretary break, I said, "I'm falling right down. And they'll give me a drink." You know, sick, crazy. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe my life. And I always say when I speak, how do you repay anybody or any organization or any fellowship for your life? What dollar figure do you put on your life? I don't know what dollar figure you put on your life. So when somebody anywhere, any time, any place asks me to share or to help, that's why Avery said she sees me everywhere. I would go anywhere. I used to go on 12. I love, the tougher they are, the better I like them. Because I've been on many 12-step calls in my 43 years. I still go on 12-step calls. I go into some of the roughest places in Savannah. Rough crack houses. I go in there. And I'm going to talk to whoever I see there, whether they hear me or not. Because that's what I've been taught to do. That secures that I'm going to get to bed that night without picking up a drink or a drug. And I have yet to be in anybody's house that looked as bad or smelled as bad as mine when I was drinking. You talk about dirty. If I dropped something on the floor and I was on a drunk, it stayed on there till I came off that drunk. I ain't bending down to pick up nothing. I ain't cleaning nothing. I ain't washing nothing. I used to go weeks without brushing my teeth. I had an afro long before afros came out. Long before afros came out, my hair was sticking on my head like this. Okay? And my hair hadn't had a comb in it in maybe 2-3 months. And I didn't care. All I knew was find 35 cents for a pint of Gypsy Rose, and there was a liquor store. And that was all I knew, and that's where I was going. Today, to wrap this up, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. Forget about beyond anybody else's wildest dreams. I'm 73 years old. I work at them, and I work. I'm not one of these 73-year-olds that sit home talking about the arthritis in my index finger. Because the arthritis in my index finger do okay without me talking about it. It do fine. It don't need me to talk about it. I get up and I go to work, and I work at a maximum to minimum secure Georgia State Prison, Coastal State Prison in Savannah, Georgia. I go in there and I talk to recovering alcoholics and addicts who are charged with crimes related to drugs and alcohol. And I go in there every single day. I ain't afraid of none of them. They all know I come from Harlem, New York, and they know I ain't afraid of them. In prisons, everybody gets a nickname. And I'm going to end with this. Everybody get a nickname. If you work in prison or go in prison voluntarily, don't think you're coming out there without a nickname. So I asked the orderly once. I said, tell me what they call me. And he was scared to death. He said, oh, Miss Wilson. I said, tell me what they call me. He said, they call you Gigi. I said, what's Gigi? Gangster Grandma. Miss Wilson, they call you Gangster Grandma. I said, okay, that's who I am. I'll accept that. Okay. I love them and they love me. And I owe it all to you. Old timers, newcomers, in between, I don't care who you are. We're all in this together. We are all here to help one another. It doesn't matter. As long as we can work with each other and help one another, that's all God wants from any of us. It doesn't matter. It's good to be sober long. I'm not going to take that away from myself and any old timer. But if you're new, keep coming. Just keep coming, because if you continue to keep coming, one day you're going to be an old timer. Thank you so much for reminding me of who I am. Thank you so much, Evelyn. I really appreciate your story. It really just makes me grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, not only for you, but for myself. I want to present you with a speaker's gift, what happened, and to show you, you know, Evelyn talked about how it was and where she came from. Well, we wanted to give her a speaker's gift, and we didn't know what to get her. And as we talked and we had conversations, I found out that Evelyn was looking for
a house in Key West. And who wouldn't want a house there? And so we decided to give her a gift card to buy something special for that place that she could remember the old timers meeting for. And thank you, and this is for you. Thank you.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.